right. Well, thanks, Jim, for agreeing to be our first subject on our happy hour with the Harriers. I'm hoping we can do this every Thursday or whatever day seems to work best for people, but and kind of showcase what we have in our midst. So today is all about Jim, who we all know is a three-time Olympian. 1996 in Atlanta, 2000 in Sydney, 2004 at Athens. He's a 13-time Norwegian champion in steeplechase, 1500 meter and 5000 meters. So his credentials are quite something. So we're just going to ask him some questions, have a conversation. So thanks, Jim, for being here.
Thanks for the invitation. I'm happy to be here. And there's quite a few Harriers, so that's good. It's good to see that.
Yeah, I know. Thank you all for tuning in. So we'll get to questions that we might all have for him, but I thought we could start out, before we get to the Olympics, Jim, whether you might be able to tell us your early development as an athlete, what you were like as a kid, what you enjoy as a child, what led you to actually become an Olympian steeplechaser, and your choices as a kid and as a teen.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to tell about that, sure. I grew up in a running family. Actually, my first coach was my brother, who is 3 years older than me. And I guess he was the one who sort of got the rest into the track and field and decided to have my dad as like a main coach for and then he became the organizer for our track club, and I guess that's how it started. I've been here in Toronto not that long, but I see all the possibilities the kids have here in terms of sports, in terms of arts or whatever it is. My village of somewhere in between 2,500 and 3,000 people, I think, which was situated probably 30 minutes by car away from the biggest city, which was Molde with a population of 20,000. So it was a small place. You had three choices. You could do like gymnastics, you could do handball, or you could do track and field. So I had to choose basically some type of sport, and I was happy it was track and field. I tried to combine some of the other sports too, and I was 14. Did some handball, I did some school sports and stuff, but not much more than that. And then
how about cross country skiing?
Started or grew into track and field at least.
Yeah. And so would you have considered your village to be, did all the kids have to choose a sport to play? Is that kind of the culture in Norway, or was it just in your family?
In my, that was fairly normal. I think in most towns or cities or villages, you do sports, some kind of sports. And actually in my class of about 25, I think 20 did track and field at one point in time. And also had like road relays in Norway, Scandinavia, probably in Europe in general. And those were very popular. So six kids in one team. And that was like sort of the main thing that attracted people from my class to join. In one point of time in one of these relays, keep it at my young days, my younger brother, who's 1 year younger than me, and myself, brother, we were half of the relay team. And we performed really, really well, like regionally in a way. So we had a good team, and would do some kind of sports. Yeah.
So, Jim, was this high school age you're referring to?
Oh, sorry. I was probably 8 when I first started track and field.
Oh, wow, you're youngin'.
We were wearing rubber boots. The first day I joined the track and field practice, it was raining a lot, and okay, I'm not gonna get wet. So, but I showed early talents, one of the coaches noticed that, because I ran against, now I was eight, the 11-year-olds too, and I would keep up. I would basically beat them already at that age. So I was, I had some early talents. Yeah. So I started early.
And so what, how did you make it in terms of, how old were you when you went to your first Olympics in 96? Without giving away your age too much.
Then I was 24. I was born in 1972. And I,
yeah.
So 1990 and 1991, when I went to the States, I got recruited for the one of the university teams in El Paso, Texas. So I, from 91 to 1996, I spent some years in the States. I became NCAA champion twice also.
In what, in what event?
In the 3,000 meters steeplechase. So maybe that is, would be like one of the questions, like how did I end up running the 3,000 meters steeplechase?
Yes.
Which is a bit of a funny story. When I was 16, we had six teams, and against Finland, Sweden, we had various young teams, three Norwegian teams, Swedish teams, and three Finnish teams. We would be competing against each other, and I was selected 800 meter. So I just finished my 800 meter. The coach of the our regional team came up to me and he said, "Hey Jim, good job! You won the race. Good job! But in 50 minutes, would you mind running the steeplechase? Because the guy who's running, he is sick at his hotel room and can't run." Well, short story, but. A long story short, but I ended up running the steeplechase, and I won the steeplechase event also 50 minutes later, and that was how I ended up. And then the year after that, I became the junior Norwegian champion in the steeplechase. So that's how I ended up going for the steeplechase. Yeah.
And so the steeplechase, is it only 3,000, like, is it 3,000 meter steeplechase, or is there a different length?
When I started, I actually ran a 1,500 meter steeplechase, and then later,
okay,
my second year, 2,000 steeplechase. And I think when you're junior European and the junior world championships, when we were 18, 19, it's the 3,000 meter steeplechase that we that I ran.
So can you just describe that for me, for us, what exactly you do in the 3,000 meter steeplechase?
Yeah.
Like what? Like what? How does it go?
I'll make an attempt. It's like, well, I think in Europe, there's no one training for the steeplechase at my age when you're 16, 17. That's something that you sort of end up doing, and then you like it or not, and you stop or you continue, but then you start practicing it. So it's a, in an event of 3,000 meters, 7.5 laps on the track, and you have 35 barriers. And then you have, of that 35, you have 7 times the water barrier passage. So it's a tough race. So the thing that I liked about it, and I still enjoy, and I'm sure Alistair enjoys it too, and I mentioned it like this, is like you get to combine everything. Your mobility, hips, it's tactical, because the finish is probably 9 out of 10 races just from the last barrier to the finish, which is often like, or mostly like 70 meters. That's when you often see at the World and the Europe Olympics, the race is being decided. So you need to have a good kick, good sprint, so compared to a 5K or a 10K runner. We mostly do to have endurance in the world and then be better than the rest at your event. In the steeplechase, you need the speed of the 1500 meter runner and the hurdle technique, strength of a hurdle runner. Then as you get tired, the barriers, I'm sure Alistair noticed that too, that the barriers, they're normally 3 feet, but at the end, in the last lap, they tend to be like 4 feet, maybe. And that is, that's the big challenge.
And the water is deep.
Yeah, the water's deep.
How deep is the water?
So I can answer a couple of these questions. So the water's 2.5 feet deep where wow. the hurdle is next to the water. It gets shallower as, so you want to jump out and land in the shallow water, even if you're really skilled, jump over the water entirely, which I think very few people do. But if you decide to go over the barrier and down, you're effectively falling 5.5 feet, which is a tremendous distance. So you definitely want to jump off the barrier. So, and Jim keeps saying, I understand, but I don't, because I was climbing over these barriers. I wasn't jumping over them. I chickened out after the first two or three. Terrifying. 3 feet is really high. Anyway.
And so, Jim.
Jim, did you hurdle all the barriers, or you did the step on the water barrier, or what was your technique for the barriers?
On the water barrier itself, I stepped on it. I could jump like 5.5 meters when I was 16, 17, but I didn't consider myself a true long jumper. And to me, it would be too far. I would end up too deep in the water, which would reduce my speed or take too much energy getting out of the water jump again. That's one thing. And the second is in the sprints and sprints, you have more control when you step on the barrier. It's not much of a step. You barely touch the barrier, but it's just enough to push you further. Because you have seen a lot of accidents happening in the last lap or the last, just during the steeplechase. And that tends to happen, I think, more often if you don't step on the barrier. So I was one of those who stepped on the barrier. But on the with other barriers, I used the hurdle technique.
And was it always the same leg, or did you alternate legs?
I could alternate. Yeah, and I think that is very important, because the thing is, since I came here, I've been also teaching steeplechase at the University of Toronto with a development team. So I've had like 5-6 kids regularly at the practice. And the thing I teach them is to do both. It's easy if you're running your race by yourself, which you may tend to do at high school, because it's not all that of a popular event yet, I think. But when you're running in a big pack of people, you don't see the barrier, all of a sudden it's there. You don't have time to switch leg, or so you have to go to your left or your right or be able to do that. That's very important.
So out of your Olympics, out of the 4 years of the three separate Olympics, what do you consider to be your best one?
Well, I guess it would be the one in Atlanta when I was eighth. I was eighth there, and I was nine, nine in Sydney. Atlanta was my first one, and I often tend to come get injured every season. And it was so in that before Atlanta, I had 3 weeks, like about 2 months before, problems with my calf. In Sydney, I had a stress fracture on top of my, which took me out about 7 weeks. And this was 2.5 months Sydney game. So.
And so how did you keep a lid on that stress of the injury leading up to the Olympics, and also just being at the Olympics? Like, what were your stress mechanisms?
I guess that's a stress mechanism, isn't it? I'm not an expert in it. When I first heard I had a stress fracture, I took an hour and I cried for an hour. and then I sort of like came to myself, like, okay, thinking, and then I asked for a second opinion with my doctor. He said, the sports physician said, forget the Olympics. You need about 10 weeks or at least 10 weeks off of your foot, no running. And then basically I would miss the qualifications. And I still needed to qualify for the Olympics that year. Then my Norwegian sports physician, so that's the Olympic team physician, told me you have two options. You could quit and then you don't run the Olympics, or you can try. And start after 6 weeks. And that's what I did. And in the meanwhile, just training like crazy in the pool. Mm-hmm. could. I was doing cycling and strength training. I could still do mobility, hip mobility and stuff like that. So just focusing on what I could do. So that was the training part, just focusing on what I could do, stay positive and still imagine myself in the Olympics and working towards as if I was qualified or were, what was going to qualify for the Olympics. And I've always been good at that part. And then, and one, like, I think one thing I want to mention is about the Olympics in Australia when, cause I was like, so Chuck Field is in the second week. It was a little bit late in the Olympics. And then people had been in, in the Olympic stadium before me, before my event. So they had told me, so they came back from the stadium and they tell me, yeah, there's one thing you should not do when you enter that stadium. Imagine it had seats for 113,000 people. They were all like waiting for a Cathy Freeman, if I don't remember wrong, the Aboriginal who won the 400 meter event too. That was the big thing. So everybody showed up. And that's also when I was going to run. So I knew there were going to be a lot of people, but they tell me, don't look up at the stands. It's huge. It's so big. Don't look up there. Okay. So what do you do when you enter the stage? you look up and you get like, carried away, you lose focus, and you think, this is different than everything else I've done. So I took a minute or two just to work on, okay, some physical things that you, just on your breathing, regain your focus, all those things. I had some, and a few stretches I always do before a race. Mm-hmm. So that's what I started focusing on, and I took
a big sip of wine.
a big sip. what else? Yeah, and then you sort of get into the race again, and you prepare, and it's okay. But that always there are so many things you can prepare for a race. But things like that, all of a sudden, you've been thrown off for because of the all the spectators or one race in the World Championships in '95 in Gothenburg. I stepped on. I have to take another bigger one. And then after 20 meters, actually, I was stepped on the cap of my shoe. So I left my shoe. Or I had to take off my shoe. And I still had, 3,000 meters basically to run. So that was tough. But I mean.
Wait, what happened to your shoe?
You didn't have a shoe?
No, so I had one foot. I had a plank and one barefoot. Yeah, that basically it. Yeah.
Oh, we're still coming up with a new nickname for you.
Yeah. But keeping with stress. I guess a few of those things have your rituals, especially on the race day, is important. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, Jen, you had emailed a question about whether or not you had, a mantra.
Yeah, I had a couple of questions for you.
Okay.
Go for it. One,
so I guess I'll ask them now. You can decide which order you want to answer them in. So one was, did you have like a particular mantra that you use time after time in a given race? What did you, so getting to nitty gritty, what did you have to give up that you hated to give up? Like the human part of you, what did you have to give up and sacrifice that you were just like, oh man, if only I can have that. And the third question is, if you were to have a time machine and were able to go back to, let's say, yourself when you're right in the prime of your training, what would you tell yourself? So three questions, you can choose to answer all of them or one of them, whichever.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
Take a big sip of wine.
about the mantra, I don't know. I happen to learn a lot about marketing, and that might sound me
a long story, but because it's very easy to get intimidated when you get into like the Olympics or World Championships or things that you have been training for, and you have a lot of respect for people. Wow, not used to talking that much again, I guess. So I in the beginning it was a little bit a few like mistakes when you sort of look at people and you see Kenya on their shirts or sorry and then you sort of get intimidated by what you see. I'm gonna go get more water. Sorry, wait a minute.
I didn't expect this with my voice.
I noticed Alistair had the big bottle of wine.
I think the thought of Sydney got him choked up a bit.
Yeah.
Going out to 100,000 people. Oh my God.
I know.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he's coughing because he's got a cough or if he's emotional.
Emotional.
If you have a cough, Dave, you don't tell anybody you have a cough. You hold that in.
I was in Sydney for the Kathy Freeman race, so I watched Jim. I'm sorry, I didn't know it was you at the time.
Oh, where are you? I was watching Jim.
I was watching Jim, and Kathy Freeman happened to show up as well, but there you go.
Okay, I'm dumb when it comes to names. Who's Kathy Freeman? Loser, sorry.
400-meter runner, Aboriginal from Australia, and she won the 400-meter gold.
Yeah, she ran a fabulous race.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, anyway, I didn't know.
Back to Jim.
She also ran in a big track suit, you know, with a hood.
And all in one thing, which
incorporated
her head as well.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, about the mantra thing, I think it's... it's often about not getting intimidated. I mean, when I told you about my village when I grew up and stuff, and it's easy to that you are not as good as whoever, like Kenyans, or if they have better shoes than you or whatever. And I got intimidated by the beginning of the race, in my career. But it was like better and better in thinking about, okay, this is what I like to do and what I enjoy. This is what I've been training for. There's no reason why other people, other runners should be better than me. So I try to stick to those type of things. And it's like being a mantra and remind myself of this. You have done this.
You deserve to be there.
I deserve to be there. I've done this a thousand times before. It's nothing special about exactly the event that you're doing. It's more the circumstances are different, of course. You're not running by yourself anymore. And all of a sudden you have like a million spectators or maybe a billion spectators watching, but around the world. So yeah, always focusing on believing in yourself and that you could, you can do it. I mean, you're well trained. You have done all the training that you were supposed to do, and then you'll do well. And focusing on yourself, I think that was the most important thing for me.
So in that regard, Jim, did you run your PBs at the Olympics? Your personal bests at the Olympics?
I never ran a PB, but I was close. Like in Atlanta, I ran when I ran like 8:16 in the final. I'd only run 8
for 3,000
in the steeplechase.
I think that was a PB, actually. Yeah, in the final. Yeah,
that would be good for just a 3,000.
The World Championships in 97 in Athens, really, really close. I think I even was. Yeah, within 1 second of my PB. And you must imagine, this is like you run on Thursday, your qualifications, and then on Friday, your semifinals, and then maybe there was a rest day, and then you would do like 2 days later, your final event. So that's chases. That's like 9,000 meters steeplechase in
in 4 days. That's tough. But I think I always recovered really well, or I was really able to do really, really well during the most important event of the year, or the every 4 year.
And so what would your recovery look like between days?
Well, you plan those things. So it starts with just getting some carbos right after the race. That is important. You continue like a good cool down. You plan all these things. You plan as if you're running the final. What do you do in between? You get the massage the day after. I didn't prefer to have it like right after a race or something, because you wanted to let your body also do some work. It's easy, of course, in the Olympic Village when you McDonald's has a big presence and all these like junk food restaurants.
Are you serious? They are there. Wow.
So it's weird to see like 10,000 athletes eating hamburgers and stuff. But I mean, that is not, I think, what makes a difference if you want to become an Olympic champion. So you have to find what you believe in and what helps your recovery. So nutrition would be good, something important. And talking to other people, because you must imagine there in an Olympic Village, everybody is like focused on their event. The other coaches are focusing on most, like, you have a feeling they're focusing more on other athletes. So you have to be very independent and know your stuff, because your own personal coach is not allowed in most cases in the village. So you have different coaches all of a sudden to help you. That's things you try to find also, like mental recovery with the playing arts or walking around in the village.
Jim, why is your own personal coach not allowed in the village?
Well, it has a limitation, because I think a lot of people have their own personal coach, and it's just, I think it's just a matter of in the one Olympic team, they get, like, I don't know, like maybe 50 coaches accredited or accreditations. So they have to make a selection of who's going to be able to get into the village and get into the stadium and stuff. Okay. My coach, he was like, he thought he could do a better job back home in Norway. He could see my race, could see what's going on outside of the racing and about the weather and stuff like that. So he just stayed home.
Okay, thanks.
And so to Jen's second question, which was what you felt like when you were growing up, what you had to give up, what you felt like was the biggest sacrifice that you had.
I guess just seeing and being with like your, probably in the beginning, like your childhood friends or something, or be... You must imagine, like, it sounds strange, but I have never had a feeling that I missed out on anything.
Okay, good.
It's also maybe, I always thought I was maybe, you know, more and more so when you get to grow older, but that I was fortunate that I was able to, like, continue my hobby, and the hobby became my work. So for me, I really appreciated that I got the chance. And then, okay, when you ask me like this, I would, if I think about it, probably I missed some that part. But it's also like you make new friends, and it's like one big family, like the Harris family. Then probably after like 5 years or. In like you're being a professional athlete, that is your safe world, and it feels good being around other runners or people understanding what you're doing and training for. And so, because I, and that also is maybe because I never lived a very, very strict life, as in you're not allowed to drink. When I got a little bit older, okay, beer or have a birthday cake or it's like I knew what I had to eat. So I took care of like the basic food had to be really, really good. But if I like had the fish and had my vegetables and stuff, if I ate something extra, that wouldn't never had a problem or difficulty with that.
Mm-hmm.
And that and like end of the season, like the Kenyans would say, you had to get out of shape, meaning it's okay to take beer. They call it like, we call it take drugs that say take beer and get out of shape and then get in shape like later. So, and I was also like able to relax during training camps and go out in between the morning session and the afternoon session and have a coffee and talk with other athletes that happen to be at the training camp, because I also knew a lot of runners who are athletes, sports, who didn't feel like, okay, I'm on a mission. I'm not allowed to go out now and drink coffee and not, I should be lying in bed and taking care of business. But for me, enjoying whatever I felt like was also for me taking part of business, so taking care of business. Like, that's why I didn't never feel like I missed out on anything. Yeah.
And Phyllis, you probably have a good follow-up question to that about getting out of the sport.
Yeah, thanks, Jim, and thanks to everybody who's coordinated this. It's really, really interesting. I mean, what I was curious about, Jim, was when you realized that that chapter of your life had come to an end, when you no longer wanted to do the work of being a high-performance athlete. So I went, you know, did that come slowly? Was it something, a realization that you had? And, you know, what did that feel like, that you would no longer have that identity, but you needed to develop a new one?
Yeah. Well, it sort of like was a gradual thing, I think, from 2002, 2003. I noticed I started getting more injuries. I was able to get to the Olympics in 2004, but that was also the first one I didn't qualify for the final for. 2005, 2006, I missed out on the, what's for in Europe, big, the European Championships and the World Championships because of injuries like in the last month or the last month prior to the championships. So injuries played a bigger and bigger role. And then what the final thing is when you decide to stop is when you lose the belief in yourself that you can be a better athlete than I was last year or that I have ever been. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That belief in yourself to get up every morning or to go out in the rain or in the snow or in the hail or in the wind, whatever, or when and once you lose that feeling, I think that's when you start rushing trainings or skip the hurdle drills or that's when I decided not so much the injury itself, but that I lost belief in myself. Then, yeah, well, that was in 2006. I sort of knew that it would come to an end. and then in 2004, I mean, between 2004 and 2006, I also took a second education at the University in Rotterdam. So when I graduated also in 2006, I was like, okay, that's when I finished. That's fine. I got some of you I know Johan Olav Koss.
It's a
steeplechaser. Sorry,
that's too much credit for him.
Speed skater.
Yeah. And initiated the organization called Right to Play for Olympic aviator Right to Play. And started working for him in the Netherlands, because after my college days, I moved with Jesse to the Netherlands, and then I had actually my career like based in Rotterdam from 1997. So then I was involved in charities, and that felt good. And then I was like back in sports, but in a different way. Yeah.
Oh, that's great! Thank you.
Was That went well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Jim, we always hear about athletes' villages that, like, once your race is done.
Here it comes.
Yeah.
Here it comes. Here it comes.
Yeah. No, it wasn't me.
So you've got all these attractive people around you. Your race is done. You won a party.
Yeah.
You know, you apparently, and you can confirm if this is true, that you get your, like, free pack of condoms when you get your room and so on. Does everybody go a bit mad after they've done their race? Party hard.
There are parties going on, but not like in the village, but yeah, there are parties. I believe there were condoms too, but the thing is, when you perform in the second week and you have a few races to do,
yeah,
you because they was told they distributed these things from the condoms from the like a nursing or like a health facility that's in the village.
Yeah.
Or if you get an injury, you could go there and you could get your MRI, you know, for condoms. But and I probably wasn't naive, and I don't have very, like, brave history. I'm not like you, Alistair, who dares to sit in front of a big lion just behind you. I have a fish, you know, a painting of a fish. That's good.
That relates to my other question. If you were to go back in time,
oh yeah.
your earlier self.
That, I have never thought of that. Of course, I haven't thought about that.
Awesome. And another question.
Yeah, more partying and stuff like that. Open eyes. But yeah, you are, I guess, the person you are. And then, I mean, like, if you.
For sure, Jim.
Yeah.
Ali, what's your other question?
The other question is, I assume you did some high altitude training. And did you ever do any of that in with the Africans in Kenya or Ethiopia?
Yeah.
And what was that experience?
I went to training from 1998. When I was in El Paso, Texas, that's at 1,200 meter altitude too. So that would be like semi thing. And from there, I would go to Colorado during spring break for a week plus an extra week. So I'd done a lot of high altitude training. But it was like in, you know, in 97, 1998, I had two good seasons. In 98, I didn't run faster than in 97. So I was like thinking, okay, what do I do after 98 to get better? So that was, I decided to go look for Kipchoge Keino in Eldoret in Kenya. He was the Olympic hero in the 68 in Mexico City and in Munich in 72. Also good, really good steeple chaser. And we went.
Who is that? Sorry?
Kip Keino. Kipchoge Keino. Huh. So he's and he had an orphanage home in Eldoret with 100 kids, and he had initiated a paid for school. So he had like a really neat facility there. But I would go three times a year, stay about 6 weeks, 4 weeks, and 3 weeks at high altitude camps. In Norway, we also had, and in Kenya, that's also like, okay, where do you find motivation to continue and to get better and to improve yourself? And for me, that was also actually going and train with the Kenyans. I believe that would help me. And so I went there, and that taught me a lot too. And like, we would go out with the 10 of us or more. Some of their best runners, and it was great. But it's, you know, we know also, I also learned that, okay, growing up in Europe has its advantages, because they would do their second training and they still hadn't had breakfast. They were still like drinking their tea.
Really?
Yeah. That they would go back after their second workout, eat, and then go sleep again. So, you know, there are a lot of poor runners just like coming out of the bushes. We would do long runs there, and kids would actually, what that's the stories about the kids with their backpacks
coming out of the bushes. We actually in the forest there. I actually experienced that with some of my long runs. They would just run with us for kilometers after kilometer, and all of a sudden, with a book under their arm and barefoot and on those
amazing
the sand roads that we had, and then all of a sudden they would disappear. And they went up in some, I don't know where they went, but gone they were after 15 minutes with our book under their arm. That was fun, and just talking, and you must imagine that kept Moses skipped. I knew he was there. You know, you're all of a sudden at the bank in Eldoret, and you're like, realize, okay, this is like a world champion, multiple world champion, won most of the Golden League races back in the early 90s. All of a sudden, you're like at the bank waiting to get your cash, and you realize it's just in front of you. You start talking. That's the surrounding or the you're at. If you go to up to Eldoret, Kenya, they're only like, or not only, but a lot of world-class runners. That was very motivating for me.
So, and Jim, did you learn from that that, you know, the Kenyans have been sort of a dominant in the middle distances and the long distances? Was there something in their training that was different from what the Europeans were doing? Is it just a matter of numbers? Did they work harder? What was it that you think they were doing that was different?
Yeah. Well, they run more than what an average European or North American kid would do at the younger age, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Numbers, yes, I believe they're with one training, we went out for a 10 times 1 kilometer, or we did 10 times 3 minutes, I'm not sure. But you would start basically with 80 runners and end, and you would finish with 6, 7, 8. I mean, it's like, where is everybody? Yeah. So, yeah. If they do different, it's different, but I think it's they basically do very, very easy morning runs. They run more dedicated to their sports. I'm not sure their training methods are better than ours. So I think if we talk about running and running technique and nutrition, I think they have much more to learn from us. So I'm afraid they really get to know all our secrets. I think what I learned the most there is to be happy with what you have. It's like also because at this orphan, so we stayed at a school, 100 kids, age basically 0 to 10, 12. And these were very, very unfortunate kids, like actually a 2-year-old girl or a 3-year-old girl or something picked up. Because she was like used as an entertainment object at one of the local pubs, dancing naked on a table, or there was a kid put away to die that had been saved and brought to this place. So when we stayed there during Christmas, it doesn't matter, probably 1999, we decided, what do we do for these kids? We didn't have much to buy either. We didn't bring that much money, and I'm not sure if I had a credit card back then. But we decided to buy some notebooks, some pencils, some color stuff, and some balloons. I'm not sure, but those things, they were all cost like $1 a gift or something. We bought like 30 of them. We went together, 3 of us, so we had a lot of these gifts, and we gave them on Christmas Eve to these kids.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah, and they like what? So we call them together, and like they're like, what's happening? So we gave them these gifts. Some started crying, some like they were really, really happy, and you noticed that and you saw that in their eyes. And the next morning we would be they woke us up a bit too early, but who cares, with a really, really nice song they had prepared for us. This is Christmas Day. Show their gratitude against what we had done. I mean, like, so I think that was of all the things that you do, what what resonated the most during all my training camps. So not so much about the
training
camps, but you know, be happy with what you have, and it's easy to look at what the neighbor has. Or I mean, if you bought something like this for Christmas Eve in Europe or in North America, I mean, your mother, their mother would be called this, and a father would be called what?
Yeah,
so we get mad. I mean, like, such a big difference. And try to take some time once in a while to think about how lucky we are.
Yeah.
I learned the most.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, guys, I'm going to have to leave, but thank you very much for hosting, and thank you very much for sharing these stories of your life.
Thank you for joining us, Phyllis.
See you guys soon.
Bye, Phyllis.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I think Jen had one other question that I thought would be good to, well, we can certainly field a lot of other questions, but if you had to, Jen, I think your question was about asking a question of your younger self, what advice you'd give to younger athletes, or it's kind of the best advice for a high performance athlete growing up.
Yeah. Well, I think, I'm not sure if I would perform better, but I think my career would last longer if I took even better care of my nutrition. I think that's the way to make sure you and to be honest, okay, the nutrition part has come further than in the 90s. I guess you know more what helps and promotes recovery. I think that would be my most...
Can you get more specific? Because when you're describing your diet, you were saying you're eating fish and vegetables. So I'm like, great.
I left out like sweet chocolates. I left out that I sometimes also ate 3 birthday cakes instead of that one slice. And you know, I ate too much sugar, and it would take me too long to refuel after practices.
Now the truth comes out.
I did not enough research when I went to Morocco in 1998. Ended up staying there 3 weeks with only eating salads, fish or meat once a week. Not enough protein, not enough fats, only like white bread, couscous, because we had three ladies taking care of us. They were cooking, but they also had their budget, again, from the owner of the location we stayed. But you saw like 2 weeks, 3 weeks after returning from that training camp, not eating enough or well enough, I experienced like a training burnout or I performed really, really well. I trained really, really well up in Morocco. I ran PBs when I got back, but that's when it sort of like all of a sudden like came to an end. So I struggled that summer for about 2-3 months to get back feeling normal again. So I think, you know, there are probably more the crucial periods in a training year that you have to take really, really, really good care of nutrition. I think that I would have taken better care of. Yeah. And I wish I had also some better coaching on like running mechanics. What I try to like, look at now and okay, seeing myself running back in the day. So it would like be okay. A little bit higher frequency would be helpful or... But again, that those are things, I guess.
Yeah.
Does that answer your question, Jennifer? Or?
Yes. No, it was very specific. It was good. Thank you. Because I noticed earlier you said something about you don't eat birthday cakes. I'm like, how do you not eat birthday cakes? And there was a reason that you would eat 3 slices.
Yeah.
It's still, I will be wondering, where's the cookies we baked yesterday? I'm sorry.
Yeah, finish those. I'm a little bit still.
Anybody else have questions for Jim?
I have a couple, Jim.
Okay.
On just international competition, just sort of how it works, where I know that before a race starts, you're in a room and you can't really do much. So I don't know how your warm up happens, because you can't really do anything before the race starts, because you're stuck in this room and you're let out onto the field and right to the line almost. So I'm just wondering about what that process is like. And then the other question is around, is the jostling and the intensity and the viciousness of international racing as bad as what you hear it is? And if you have a story around that, some crazy story.
Yeah, good question. Yeah. And Ari also had questions. And how is time running?
Well, we've got no limit.
That's critical.
But we've got no limit.
Okay. Well, Patrick, to the warm-up procedure. So during the Olympics or at the World Championships, or I think most big races, you have a cold room that you actually have to go to. It's about an hour before your race. And after the last hour before your race, you're basically not allowed to do anything in terms of warm-up. So you have to sort of complete your warm-up an hour before. Those things you have to practice by yourself prior to the games as well. So that's a big thing. You're allowed probably 12 minutes before your event out on the track again, if you're lucky, and then you do a couple of strides. So in that hour in the cold room, you're basically just, maybe you're watching another race, stretching, drinking a little bit, try to jump up and down at the spot what you're doing, chat a little bit, you smell at the shirt of the Kenyans and you think, wow, wouldn't show some respect, you could have taken a shower last week or something, but I mean, they are those things. Yeah, they could be pretty bad. And then you go with, 40 minutes before your race, like in Atlanta, you're being taken from the warm-up track into the other stadium. You go with the 12 of you running that race in one, like a bus, minibus. You're sitting face-to-face to your competition, right? But it's quiet. You don't talk to each other. You're like face down, focus. that's the big part. I don't have many stories. It's only thing like in Atlanta in 1996, during the warm-up, this is one that guy literally was preparing for the 800, right? Like an Italian who just fainted on the ground. Because if you do too much warm-up in the heat, you don't drink fuel well, you have that, you don't take care maybe of the stress or the stress mechanisms, and that could happen. So he just hit the tartan with a hard smack as I was doing strides sort of next to him. It's a tough game if you don't take care of your business, I guess.
And then the viciousness on the track. Any stories around that? Is it really lots of jostling, elbowing?
There is. I mean, especially in the steeplechase, you have to protect your space in front of the barriers. I mean, I've especially in front of the water jump, I have had people trying to cross in right in front of you. And then the sharper your elbow, the better. I just squeezed the triceps like here when he tried to cut in front of me, so like out and he's like you have to be creative and have to be not offensive but aggressive, but aggressive, you have to take care and secure your own space and make sure you have a good view towards the barrier. It's not like we start talking to each other during the race and call each other names.
So Steve posted a couple of the YouTube videos about your finals. I think I posted them on Facebook page. So you were clearly the tallest in the group. Was that like being taller? Was that good or bad? Was it a benefit?
No, I think it had advantages in terms of approaching the barriers. Sure. But then again, mostly the Kenyans went 1, 2, and 3, and they would be like 169, 170, and I had a 16 centimeter advantage on them, but it's all only limited to the, I think, the approach to the barriers, I think, being for the steeplechase.
Hey, I had a, so this is fantastic. I have one, I'm not sure if you watched the Atlanta US Marathon Trials. I thought that one really cool thing about that day, that was a fantastic day, but they lit the Olympic flame again. Did you watch?
Did you bring sorry, I didn't watch the specific race.
Yeah, I was just thinking that if seeing the flame and everything brought back the memories from Atlanta. I thought that was
No, I didn't see it, but yeah, I often.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah, I was just wondering.
I have a picture hanging around here somewhere in the room.
Hey, show some photos.
So I often think of back on Atlanta. Yeah.
I need to sign off because the kids just came up to say, "Mommy, where's dinner?" So I need to sign off.
Okay, we probably all have to attend to dinner as well. So,
Yeah.
Jim, thank you. Thanks
I just got the call as well.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jim. That was awesome.
Thanks.
Thanks,
Jim. Nice seeing you all. I look forward to the next interview.
Yeah.
I'm sure there will be a good one.
Yeah, thank you. It was awesome to have you launch this, and it was great to see you guys and your faces, and I miss you all. And
yeah,
we will get back to running together soon.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Guys. John Torrey a runner.
Sooner than later.
Yeah. What's that, Jen?
I think we need to make John Torrey a runner.
Yeah, no kidding. Oh, yeah. Anyway, stay well, everybody, and thank you so much, Nellie, for setting up the phone call. This was awesome.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just big thank you. Big hugs to everybody.
Yeah. All right. Have a good weekend.
Bye. Bye. Have a good night.
Good dinner. Bye. Bye.